This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block. Episcopalian priests, take note. The Catholic Church wants you. The Vatican is making it easier for Episcopalian clergy and their parishes to join the church. And as NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports, for a limited time, it is waiving the centuries-old tradition of priestly celibacy.
Mark Lewis, the rector of St. Luke's Episcopal Church in Bladensburg, Maryland, was surfing the internet for news one morning when something caught his eye. The Catholic Church was announcing a process to allow Episcopal churches to convert as a group. Lewis, who's theologically conservative, was intrigued.
I was immediately thrilled, and I read it to my wife, and her response wasn't as exuberant as mine.
Lewis's wife was also drawn to Catholicism, but was not so sure about answering to the Pope. Still, over several months, their church studied the Bible and Catholic doctrine and concluded that Catholicism was the one true church. In October, the priest, the church, and its 70 members converted en masse. Once that happened, Lewis could no longer lead St. Luke's because he isn't a Catholic priest, but he hopes to become one soon. Later this month, he, along with several dozen Episcopal ministers, will begin the process of becoming Catholic priests. So, what about celibacy? After all, many Episcopal clergy are like Lewis, with a wife and family. Well, the Vatican decided to waive the celibacy requirement only for those who are already married.
Oddly enough, that doesn't seem to be that big a deal. And what I mean by that is it's so much more important to come home to the place that you believe is truth. Being a Catholic means more than anything to my wife and myself.
This isn't the first time that Rome has welcomed married Episcopal priests. It's allowed individuals to join the priesthood since 1980, bringing their wives with them. But it is the first time entire parishes can follow them. Yesterday, the Vatican released the details. The former Episcopal churches will get their own diocese, or ordinariate, which will be based in Houston and led by Jeffrey Steenson, a former Episcopal bishop. Of course, some Episcopal leaders say the Pope is, quote, stealing sheep. But the Pope says his church is simply meeting a need at a time when many Episcopalians are unhappy with their denomination's actions, such as elevating gay men and lesbians to be bishops. So far, more than 100 Episcopal priests and 1,300 parishioners have asked to join the Catholic Church. Mark Lewis hopes he'll be wearing Catholic robes by summer. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
We want to turn our attention now to sports. Ibtihaj Muhammad is currently training about 40 hours a week, hoping to qualify for the 2012 London Olympics. Her dedication and skill would cause her to stand out anyway, but there's another reason she does her hijab, which she wears while competing. She hopes to become the first American Muslim woman to compete and hopefully win at the Olympic Games wearing a hijab. And she was nice enough to take a break from her busy schedule to talk with us more about her sport and her faith. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
For listeners not familiar with fencing, could you tell us a little bit more about the sport and also about your particular weapon? You compete in the saber, if I have that right.
Yes. A lot of people have seen fencing in movies like The Parent Trap or have an idea of it from Zorro. And it's, I guess, something similar to that. We use weapons and I'd like to describe it as the physical chess. It's very tactical, and you have to be athletic, and it's really exciting.
I do want to mention that you are ranked number 2 among U.S. women using that weapon.
Yep.
So that's no small achievement there. I just want to let people know that you're highly accomplished in your field. How did you get interested in fencing?
I was driving past my local high school. I think I was about 12 with my mom, and she noticed the fencing team practicing in the high school. From the road, and you know, she suggested that I try it when I got to high school. And what drew us to fencing was the long sleeves and long pants that the fencers wore. As a practicing Muslim woman, I knew that I would not only have to find a sport that accommodated my religious beliefs, but also where I could be fully covered and not have to change the uniform.
And had you played any sports before?
Yeah, I have. I think back then I ran track. I played softball and a little bit of tennis.
But you were younger than 12, so you were not yet at the age where you would be expected to begin covering. Is that it?
No. But when I got to high school, I played 4 years of volleyball, I played softball, and You know, with volleyball, you were my teammates wore spandex and like a tank top. That was our team uniform. And I wore a T-shirt underneath the tank top, and I wore sweatpants. So fencing was a bit different in that I didn't have to alter the uniform at all, and I really felt a part of the team.
What is it that you like about it? Obviously, it took to you, and you've taken to it. What do you think what do you like about it, and why do you think you're good at it?
You know, it's tough. I enjoy being able to critique myself when I'm finished fencing, whether I win or lose. I like that I can, you know, pick apart that particular bout. I know how I scored touches, how I lost touches or points. You know, it's really easy to, you know, lose and be able to fix your mistakes. Whereas on a team, you know, I guess whether you win or lose can be in the hands of someone else. And I've never felt comfortable with that.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with Ibtihaj Muhammad. She is a fencer. She has her sights set on the 2012 London Olympics. She's currently ranked number 2 among U.S. women using her weapon, the saber. And she is also a Muslim American, and she plans to compete wearing her hijab. She hopes to be the first Muslim American woman to compete at an Olympic Games, in fact, wearing hijab. I know you said you were looking for a sport where you didn't have to modify the uniform, where hopefully you'd actually just fit in more and didn't feel kind of having to make these accommodations, but you have had to make accommodations to compete. For example, I understand that you participated in a training camp in Colorado Springs, which was during Ramadan, mm-hmm. where the observant fast from sunup to sundown. How did you accommodate the rigorous training schedule, especially at altitude, right, while fasting and also refraining from taking water? How did you do it?
You know, that was honestly, I think, one of the toughest Ramadans that I've had in my experience while fasting. Not only, you know, abstaining from eating or drinking, but also, as you said, the altitude. Trying to be an athlete and train at a really high altitude is tough. You dehydrate a lot faster. You're susceptible to injury when you're dehydrated. So we were training twice a day, and I found that meeting with the trainers at the Olympic Training Center, they were really, really helpful. They put me on a strict diet. Like, I didn't have a lot of salt intake. I had to wake up periodically in the night to consume Gatorade and water to make sure that I didn't suffer from dehydration. And the tough thing about it is, you know, when you're not drinking and you're training at this level, you do suffer from dehydration. And I did have a few muscle strains and pulls during that time, but you know, fasting is a part of my life. Being Muslim is a part of my life. And, you know, fencing, I work into it. But I wouldn't fence if it hindered, you know, me practicing my religion in any way.
But won't the Olympic Games in 2012 coincide with Ramadan?
Yeah, they will.
Well, how do you anticipate adjusting? I guess you'll have to do the same thing, right? Hydrate at night. And I don't know. What are you going
to
do?
I mean, honestly, if I'm blessed to make the team, then that's like the furthest thing from my mind, you know, having to fast while competing. I've done it before, and, you know, I feel as though I'll cross that bridge and I get to it. It's not something that I worry about.
You know, people often these days, the narrative around being Muslim American is, you know, you get sort of these sort of polar opposite perspectives. On the one hand, you know, there was a series on a reality series that is just actually concluding this weekend, mm-hmm. called All American Muslim. You know, the idea obviously is to show that, you know, Muslims are Americans like everybody else and they do the same stuff. And, mm-hmm. you know, they want to play sports and, you know, they have their family squabbles and, you know, men do the dishes and, you know, excuse me, it's not a big deal. Mm-hmm. And yet, then there's this other thing where there's this other sort of narrative where people are, there's a constant tension and are people treating you differently because of your hijab or your religious practices. And then there's the other story of, can we really trust these people? Are they really our fellow, you know, patriots? Are they really loyal to the country and so forth? And I'm just, you know, we're talking about your sport. And really, if we weren't talking about the accommodations of Ramadan and the uniform, we could really be talking to sort of any other athlete. I guess what I'm wondering is, in your world, does the fact of your being a Muslim American matter a very great deal, except for the fact that it is important to you as in your own individual way and as a part of who you are? Does that make sense? Do you understand what I'm asking?
It does. Mm-hmm. You know, being a Muslim American is not easy at all. It's very difficult. And the way I practice Islam speaks for itself. And, you know, people can either accept me or they can choose not to. And I feel the same way about the show. I don't think that All American Muslim in any way represents who I am. I like to think that I'm a very conservative Muslim. And I think that a lot of the Muslims on that show, I would say, are extremely liberal. But when you do have people who have this closed-minded view of what Islam is, it's easy to group us all into one box or one category.
What do you hope, though, that in part your participation in the Olympics will, if you are lucky enough to make the team, will have some positive benefit in how people view Muslims and Islam? Or would you really prefer that they not think about your religion or your religious identity when you're competing?
I mean, the reality is that I am different. I mean, I'm African-American and I do wear the hijab. So I know that I look completely different from my teammates. And I don't expect everyone to ignore that fact. I mean, even with them fencing, yes, there are very, very few Muslims. I'm the only Muslim on the team, but there are even fewer, I'd say, minorities. To some way, you know, encourage or inspire minority youth, religious minorities in the country to see themselves in this space. I know that I've accomplished a lot, but I think that there's definitely more ground to cover. I mean, fencing has done so much for me. You know, it helped me get into a really great university. And I wouldn't be where I am in my life without fencing, without sports. And it's helped me focus in so many ways. So if my message reaches anyone, I hope that it reaches more kids than anything. I want them to be comfortable in their own skin and be comfortable with practicing their religion. And not only in the United States, but everywhere.
Ibtihaj Muhammad is a fencer. She currently ranks number 2 among U.S. women using her particular weapon, the saber. She is training to compete in the 2012 Olympics, which will be held in London. And she was kind enough to join us today from our studios in New York. Ibtihaj, thank you so much for speaking with us, and good luck to you and everything. Keep us posted.
Michelle, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Please join us tomorrow for our regular Faith Matters conversation. We'll talk about the observance of Epiphany, or Three Kings Day. We're going to continue talking about matters of faith and spirituality. It's the first week of the new year, and that means New Year's resolutions for many people. But of course, not everybody can pull them off. Our next guest, Jana Reese, has some advice for those of us who reach for the stars and still fall a little bit short. Jana says she connected with God as a teenager on a mountaintop on one inspired snowy night years ago. But 25 years later, she said she felt she and her faith were as distant, well, taking each other for granted, like an old married couple. So she came up with a year-long plan to change that. She decided to take on one spiritual practice a month. The result is the very funny memoir, Flunking Sainthood, and Jana Reese joins us now to talk about some of her misadventures in the world of spirit and faith. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thank you.
So your original plan was to just read up, not just, but to do kind of some intensive reading in the different spiritual practices and the theologies and ideas of different faiths around the world. And then you decided to take it up a notch and actually adopt a practice. How did you come up with that idea?
Yes. I decided that it would be boring for people to read about someone reading and that I should do an accompanying spiritual practice for each reading that I did. And so I upped the ante, maybe a little bit to my dismay as the year progressed, and I found that I was failing at the spiritual practices that I tried.
How did the reading go, at least?
The reading went great. I'm good at that
You're
part.
You're good at that part of it. But the practicing, actually putting into practice, not so great. So I know that you did a month-long fast, like the Ramadan fast that observant Muslims undertake. And I do want to mention that you picked February.
Yes, that was not an accident. I chose February because I wanted to get out of the way. For one thing, I thought it would be hard, and it was. But also because the days are short and the month is short. So February seemed like a really good time to fast.
But you still couldn't cut it quite.
Yeah.
What was the hardest part?
Well, you know, with the fasting, my failure was not in the actual fast because I didn't cheat on the fast. But I found that it revealed to me how shallow I was and that the fasting experience showed me that I was fasting for the wrong reasons, that I was either trying to lose weight or to manipulate God, you know, by
praying. See, look how good I'm doing.
Exactly. God, please honor this sacrifice that I'm making. And I think a lot of people approach spiritual practice in that way, and that may not be the best approach.
What are some of the other things that you try?
I tried to find God through housekeeping. That was in March. I tried a couple of different prayer practices. One is called contemplative prayer or centering prayer. One is the Jesus prayer, which comes from Eastern Orthodoxy. Oh, I tried to be a Christian vegetarian for a month. I tried to raise $4,000 for charity. And to one degree or another, and in different ways, I failed at all of these practices.
And why do you think that is? We're happy you got here on time, though. You succeeded at that. Thank you. That was great.
Thank you. I was on time.
Fully
well,
dressed,
I'm in the NPR mothership
Excellent.
Today. I had to be on time to see this great place. So why did I fail at all these practices? I think that we are human. I am human. It's hard for us to admit that. I think here we are sitting at the beginning of a new year. A lot of people are making resolutions, whether they are for finances or weight loss or spirituality. There will come a time during this year when we fall short of what we're doing. And the decision at that point is to wonder, well, is it worthwhile to continue to sort of pick up the pieces and continue and learn from this failure, or do I just stop here and quit?
Now, not being mean here, but there is an argument to be made that the skipping around is itself why you failed. You know, there's a saying, nothing's fun until you're good at it. And that these practices are, by their definition, things to be worked at over time. And in fact, over years, there are many practices from many traditions, you know, yoga, contemplative prayer, even fasting, that are enriched in the habit of doing over years, over lifetimes. So really, is it any wonder that you couldn't master it in a month? And in fact, your thought that you could master it in a month is kind of a little shallow.
It was naive. It was definitely naive. And, you know, you mentioned yoga, which is something that I practice. It's not in the book, but I started doing yoga in my mid-30s, and now I'm 42, and I feel like I'm only just now getting it. I love yoga. I look forward to yoga, and I have for years, but there's something deeper in that practice now for me. So you're absolutely right that people need to invest far more than just 30 days.
And now at the end of the year, now we're having fun with this, and you've been a really good sport about letting me, you know, pick on you a little, tweak you a teeny bit about this. But at the end of the year, you had to deal with a pretty big spiritual challenge involving your father. Will you tell us a little bit more?
Sure. Well, my dad left when I was 14 years old, left our family, took all the money. It was very traumatic. And when I was, you know, I had just turned in the manuscript for this book when I was 40 years old, I get a phone call from a hospital in Mobile, Alabama, saying my father is dying and he's all alone. Would someone from the family please come to be there and also to make the decision whether to take him off life support, which, as you can imagine, was, you know, out of nowhere for me and very difficult. And so I had to make the decision of whether to go, and I did decide to go. What I discovered was that these practices that had felt like failures, in one way or another, had formed me into the kind of person who could go and forgive him from my heart and to pray for him and mean it.
And finally, before we let you go, you do have a faith tradition of your own to which you adhere. You're a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, as I understand it. I don't want to call it dabbling, because that's not exactly what you do. Did your trying these practices kind of loop back to your own tradition in some way and kind of deepen your practice for yourself or not? Perhaps not. I don't know.
No, definitely. I feel like I am a better Christian for having tried these practices, you know, some of which were from Judaism. The month I spend on the Orthodox Jewish Sabbath taught me, informed me on how I keep the Sabbath. And I think actually that sort of weekly break is something that anybody could implement, whether they are religious or not. It's tremendously restful in a very hurried culture.
And anything else that you would recommend to anybody who doesn't necessarily want to flunk statehood, sainthood? Sorry, for sainthood. Anything
yes,
else
don't
you'd recommend?
Set out to flunk. Don't have that be your goal. I think the other thing that I would say is applicable for everyone is generosity, the sense of just giving for other people.
Jana Rees is the author of Flunking Sainthood, A Year of Breaking the Sabbath, Forgetting to Pray, and Still Loving My Neighbor. She joined us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
If you missed any of our conversation, you can hear it at npr.org/tellmemore.
The Republican presidential candidates are debating again this morning in New Hampshire, barely 12 hours after meeting for their last debate. The candidates squabbled over spending, national security, and military service, but on the question of religious liberties, they were in agreement. Newt Gingrich railed against what he called anti-Christian bigotry. Mitt Romney agreed, and Rick Perry promised to end what he called the Obama administration's war on religion. We'll have more on the debates later in the program. First, NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty examines the argument that religious freedoms are under attack in America.
If you're looking for evidence that the Obama administration is hostile to faith, conservatives say, the new health care law is Exhibit A. The law requires employers to offer health care plans that cover contraceptives. Churches don't have to, but religiously affiliated charities, hospitals, and colleges do. According to attorney Hannah Smith at the Beckett Fund, that did not sit well with the Catholic monks at Belmont Abbey College.
When the government said to them, you're going to have to fund contraception, sterilization, in violation of your deeply held religious convictions, the monks at Belmont Abbey College knew that they just couldn't do that.
They sued in federal court in November.
This is really about government coercion of religious individuals and institutions.
Religious conservatives see an escalating war with the Obama White House. One Catholic cardinal called it, quote, the most secularist administration in history. Bishop William Laurie of Bridgeport, Connecticut, who heads the Bishop's Committee on Religious Liberty, believes the First Amendment is clear. The government cannot make people choose between obeying the law and following their faith.
If the government can force a church's hand and force it to violate its cherished beliefs, then what's next?
That happened, Laurie notes, when Catholic Charities in Illinois shut down its adoption services because it was unwilling to place children with same-sex couples, as the state required. The church also lost a federal contract to aid victims of human trafficking because the administration favored groups that provide contraceptive and abortion services. Laurie says the government should accommodate their beliefs.
We don't have a constitutional right to a contract, but we do have a constitutional right not to be discriminated against because we're following our own convictions.
I am tired of hearing religious right organizations or the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church play the victim.
That's Rob Boston at Americans United for the Separation of Church and State.
All we're really seeing here right now is a very modest attempt from the Obama administration to put some controls on how some government money is spent when it flows to religious organizations. It's a perfectly reasonable thing that, quite frankly, should have happened a long time ago.
Is the Obama administration hostile to religion?
No.
Douglas Laycock is a constitutional lawyer who argues cases on behalf of religious groups.
I think they've aggressively protected religious liberty on some issues and failed to protect it on other issues. But they're not hostile. The hostility is in parts of the political culture, particularly in the gay rights movement and the pro-choice movement.
It's a larger culture war, he says, a fight that religious conservatives are worried about losing, particularly over gay rights. More and more people favor civil unions and marriage for gay couples, and more states are recognizing them, prompting this assessment by Matthew Staver at the conservative law group Liberty Council.
I believe the greatest threat to religious liberty is the clash between religious liberty and LGBT rights.
Staver says as rights for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people make gains, religious conservatives are having to set aside their convictions. A court clerk was told to issue same-sex marriage licenses despite religious reservations. A Christian wedding photographer was sued for refusing to shoot a same-sex wedding. Staver says these people are not trying to impose their religious views on others.
What people of faith don't want to do, however, is be forced to participate in something that literally cuts to the very core of their religious belief.
Rob Boston says religious people cannot discriminate any more than a restaurant owner can cite the Bible in refusing to serve African Americans. He says the solution is simple.
If you don't want to serve the public, don't open a business saying you will serve the public.
Douglas Laycock says the culture wars have become a zero-sum game. When one side wins, the other loses.
The conservative religious groups want to take away all the liberty of the pro-choice people and the gay rights people, and the pro-choice and gay rights people want to take away all the liberty of the conservative religious groups, and neither side seems interested in the American tradition of live and let live and protect the liberty of both sides.
And Laycock sees little chance of a détente, particularly in an election year. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.